What's up, State of Hockey? It's another edition of One-on-One with Joe O'Donnell. That's right, a couple episodes in quick succession for you. But with the regular season looming, figured it'd be a great time to get some more content out there, talk a little Minnesota Wild hockey. That's right, the home opener, October the 12th against the Florida Panthers. It's here, it's upon us, and the Wild will begin their 82-game grind of a regular season in hopes of another Stanley Cup playoff berth. As always, One-on-One with Joe O'Donnell, presented by SodaStick. Go to SodaStick.com to get your original Minnesota-inspired goods. All of their apparel is designed and screen-printed here in Minnesota on super soft, super comfy shirts and hoodies. You'll absolutely love it. And don't forget, we'll hook you up. That's right, for being a listener of One-on-One with Joe O'Donnell. You can get 15% off your next order. Use code One-on-One for 15% off. That is SodaStick.com, SotaStick.com, SodaStick.com, designed by Minnesotans for Minnesotans, code 101 for 15% off your next order. My guest today on One-on-One with Joe O'Donnell is Wes Walls, a former NHLer, 13-year NHL career. Played for five different teams, of course, a lot of time with the Minnesota Wild, parts of seven seasons in a Minnesota sweater. He's the current Bally Sports television analyst and studio host, and a guy I like to consider a good friend on the road. Sometimes my running mate on the airplane. Walsy, thanks for joining me. How you doing, bud?
Yeah, great to be with you, Joe. I listen to the podcast. Anytime something else comes down the chute, I'm always paying attention. So I love what you're doing with the podcast. And yeah, the last couple, 3 years, it's been great to get to know you, especially on the plane when we get out on the road. You know, once the season starts, especially with the radio broadcast and TV stuff, we don't cross over, you know, pretty much unless we really get out on the road together. So it has been nice to connect with you and get to know you, you know, a lot better.
How excited are you for a new season with your role with the Wild on the TV side? And what's this time of year like for you as you start to prepare and get ready?
Well, to be honest with you, the last 2-3 weeks, it's been pretty quiet. Like after my hockey school ends, the whole month of August, I'm pretty much in a hockey rink with young kids from 7 to 13 years old from the whole month of August, four straight weeks. So after the month of August is over, it's nice to just be able to throw my feet up and just hang out and spend time with my family. But so there is some downtime the month of September to kind of get ready for the start of the hockey season. And, you know, now that the hockey season's here with the Minnesota Wild, obviously I'm really looking forward to, you know, to being around the team for another season. And, you know, Joe, just seeing if this team can grind its way into another, you know, playoff situation where we can be playing in April. I think a lot of Wild fans, you know, anytime I talk to Wild fans, I'm around hockey people all the time. And I'm sure you hear it too, because you've got kids in youth hockey. A lot of the fans and people are disappointed that the Wild, you know, haven't been able to get past the first round. But I'm quick to remind people, and I don't know how you handle it, Joe, but I'm quick to remind people about how difficult it actually is to make the playoffs. And 8 of the last 9 years, it's really been a hell of a run. It really, really has. I know, like, the success in the playoffs haven't been there. But to make the playoffs is obviously very, very challenging. And, you know, the fact that the Wild have been able to do it, especially the last couple of years, considering the cap restraints this team has had, it's been remarkable. And it pretty much tells me all I need to know about the heart in that locker room, playing against other teams that are spending $10 to $15 million more dollars than us. So looking forward to see if the Wild can stay healthy, get great goaltending, you know, win close games, and who knows what can happen in April if the Wild do make the playoffs.
Your role as a studio host, analyst on the TV broadcast, you've been doing it for a number of years now. What do you like the most about that part of your day job, if you will? Obviously, you got five kids, you're a busy family man, you're coaching youth hockey, all those things, the West Walls Hockey School. But when it comes to getting on air and in a hockey market where, you know, the fans are very savvy, they know what's going on, you can't sugarcoat things. What's that like?
I've really grown. I think this is year 11 for me. I've really grown to love it. And obviously I mentioned earlier, we sit together on the plane and I see the amount of preparation that you put in between games, flying from city to city, getting your notes, getting your mind, getting everything ready. That's the part, Joe, that I actually love the most too, is actually the preparation and digging into, you know, digging into who we're playing next, potentially going back and putting my coaching hat on, if we happen to play the Florida Panthers and I'm working pre and post, I won't do much of this. I am doing pre and post for the Florida game. But because we haven't seen Florida play this yet, like for instance, if we get into game 10 and we're playing the Dallas Stars, I like to watch their two or three games before special teams and kind of break things down and maybe pull into the pre and post game show some things that maybe Wild fans could look for during the game. So I almost turn into a bit of a coach. And when I'm doing pre and post show, I get that kind of opportunity and time to kind of be able to explain to the fans at home. When you're in the booth and you're doing the you're analyzing up there with Anthony LaPanta, sometimes the game moves so fast you don't really have a whole lot of time to elaborate on different situations and games, things that happen during the game. But being up in the booth doing the color for 20, 25 games of the season, and then pre and post, 25 to 30 games of the season, allows me some flexibility. And I got to be honest, I enjoy both sides of it. And like I mentioned, the preparation part is the part that kind of connects me the most, and I feel like I know what's going around the league. And then obviously working with Anthony LaPanta, who's a true pro, and he's made the transition for me from the pre and post here 3, 4 years ago up into the booth as easy as possible. It's not as easy as everyone, as guys like you that have been doing it for years and years make it look. I have a lot of respect for all you guys that do that, but working with Kevin Gorg and being around Karts and Ryan Carter and just good guys and good people and producers that want to make the show look great, and everyone's committed. So I enjoy doing it, and but I would say probably the preparation I enjoy the most.
How did it come about initially, to get involved in TV? Was it something while you played that you thought you might be into?
No, not really. Actually, when I came back from Tampa Bay, when I was coaching out there in Tampa for a couple of years, it came back to the Minnesota Wild. And to be perfectly honest with you, Chuck Fletcher was the general manager at that time, and I quietly wanted to try to see if there was any possible way I could kind of get involved in the on the hockey ops side of things. I felt like I had a lot to bring to the table, just the way my career went and my experiences. And to be honest with you, there weren't a whole lot of openings, even on the scouting side. If they wanted me to travel and get out and watch kids and work with younger players and stuff. So I tried to get in kind of on the hockey ops side. And then Matt Maker reached out to me at that time. He's now the president, but at that time he was the CFO, and reached out to me and asked me if I'd be interested in getting involved on the business side slash doing some television stuff. So that's when I kind of sat down with to be honest with you, Joe, when I sat down with the folks at Bally's and Matt Maka, I was terrified about being on television. Like, I mean, you don't even know how terrified I was, because I know enough. I was probably a good interview when I played, but I know enough to know that just because you're a good interviewer, like a good interview when you played, that doesn't really always relate to being good on television. And so the first year or two, I was very fortunate that I didn't get fired. I just, they kind of stuck with me, and maybe they knew that my work habits were good and I was going to continue to work and get better and better. And I like to think, a lot like being a hockey player, I never thought it was great, and I don't think I'm great even as a broadcaster. And I just want to continue to try to get better and better, and I think I've done that. And so, yeah, Joe, terrified the first couple of years, but I did jump into it with both feet. And slowly, after you get over the initial, the deer in a headlight thing, and you can actually articulate a thought or two, that's when it become more fun for me, because and that's when you can kind of open your mind up and share with the fans at home exactly what you're seeing.
How about on TV, the first time you got a director talking into your little IFB earpiece? You're
Oh
trying to
gosh.
finish a thought. They're telling you got 10 seconds to wrap it up, or hey, we're showing you this graphic next. What was that like?
Yeah, that was hard, man. That was hard. And actually, not just even looking from single shots to double shots, like not actually looking at a human being when you're trying to
Yeah.
speak, and not seeing the face, the face gestures of the person you're talking to. That took some getting used to. And but yeah, the producers and the producers are all great, but there was a time after the first 10 or 15 games where I actually had to sit down. I can't remember who the producer was, it's so many years ago, where I had to say, like, we need minimal talking in my ears, and anytime a word comes out, it can't have more than one syllable. Like it's got to be like no two, three, four syllable words. Let's just quick, like one syllable, because I'm not good enough to be able to move around with all this. And honestly, the producers were great. They listened to the announcers. They kept it to a minimum, and it really helped me progress and get a little bit better. But Joe, oh, that was not easy. Not easy.
As a player, was it like if Jacques Lemaire just said win the draw, you knew what to do? If he said forecheck, you knew what to do. So it's just simplify.
That's it. That's it. And that's all I really know. That's all I really knew, especially playing under Jock. Just keep the game as simple as you possibly can and don't beat yourself. So yeah, that's a good way to look at it. And that's I shared that with the producers, and like I mentioned, they were great with trying to make it as easy for me as they possibly could.
I'm going to circle back to Jacques Lemaire and some of your Wild playing days in just a minute, but let's dive into this Wild team. You talked about trying to win close games, hopefully staying healthy and grinding it out for another playoff spot. A big part of the success this year is going to be some young guys. Kalen Addison, Brock Faber, Marco Rossi, they're all going to have to play and contribute, in my opinion. I don't think that's, breaking news. It's not rocket science. But for Rossi in general, what does he need to do to be a regular contributor this year?
Well, I mean, he's going to have to produce more. I mean, to be a regular contributor and playing the top nine, Joe, you can't have one assist in 20 games. So that's it. Let's just start there. And I don't think the organization is looking at Marco Rossi after 20 games this season, saying that he has to have like 13 points in 20 games. But he does need to create more offense for sure. He's an offensive gifted player. We know that. It was really interesting. They had Billy Guerin on the broadcast, one of the preseason broadcasts. I think it was the first one when we played against the, I don't know. I think it was maybe we played Colorado. And I was listening to Billy Guerin talk, and it was interesting to hear Billy and some of his comments where he basically, the same question was really posed to Billy Guerin, just talking about what does Marco Rossi need to do to become a great player. And he said he's just got to relax. He's got to relax and just go play hockey. He said during the interview that he thought that Marco Rossi is wired a certain way that he almost cares too much, if there's such a thing. And Billy was right. There is such a thing as caring too much. There really, really is. And I was 20 years old in this league too, Joe, when I came in. And my first few years in the league are looking a lot like Marco Rossi's too. And I cared way too much too. And there's something to be said for just taking chances. That was one of the other things Billy said. Like, look at the guys you're playing with. You've got Freddie Gaudreau, who's an unbelievable defensive player. Marcus Foligno is your other winger, who I think has gotten Selke votes the last 3 years in a row. Like, you're allowed to take some chances. It's not like you're playing with guys that are hanging on to play in the NHL. So he's going to get a lot of rope, Joe. I think with a cap situation the Wild are in, I don't think you're going to see a lot of people moving up and down. So I think that might help put his mind at ease, thinking, okay, I'm going to be here. Like, now it's up to me to make sure that I can, make plays and obviously play defensively well too. But I think for me, Joe, and I don't know how you feel about it, but you look at Sam Steele was a centerman here. Marco's going to get a lot of that ice time. I mean, 10 to 15 goals and 20 to 25 assists, 30, 35, 40 points, I don't think is, especially if he plays here all season long and plays in the second unit of the power play, I don't think between 30 and 40 points is too much to ask, as well as being great defensively. And then let's build this sucker brick by brick.
How much do you believe the first one going into the back of the net in a regular season game will benefit him?
Big, obviously the last couple of years he's put up good numbers in the preseason. Well, especially last year, but even in this preseason, he's made a lot of plays. He made a nice assist to Patrick Maroon to tie up the game up there in Chicago. But it's important, Joe. And you bring up a good, not a good point. You bring up a great point. And because I think about the year, people forget Eriksson Ek there when he was playing behind Mikko Koivu for 3 years. I think he had six, seven, and
I was
eight
going to say
goals a
six
season.
goals. Yeah.
Yeah, like that's what he was scoring a year, playing 13, 14
And
minutes.
everybody, by the way, was ready to jump off the bandwagon. Brock Besser was the
Oh,
pick. They
yeah.
screwed it up.
Oh,
And
yeah.
everybody I talked to, because he came to Iowa a few times, and I don't mean to
Yeah.
cut you off, Wes, but like
No, it's good.
I talking to management, talking to the coaches, talking to, just people in the organization, they're like, this kid is legit. It's just taking some time, right? He'd come to Iowa and dominate, even if it's one game for a paper transaction, come down, play a game, go back up. Like, he was a man amongst boys in the AHL, and he just kind of knew, just stay with the process.
See, that's the advantage you had that I didn't have, because I wasn't down in the American League watching him play down there. I was just watching the product up at the National Hockey League level. And the product that I saw up in the National Hockey League level those years playing behind Mikko Koivu and Eric Staal, I was a lot like the fans, I'm not going to lie, where I was like, okay, I don't know what we have here. Maybe it's time to package him together and then all of a sudden, and you brought up the point about scoring early, in a season when you're trying to make your move as a player. His breakout year, I believe he had 19 goals, Joe. And I'm almost positive, Joe, and I could be wrong, and I know you know this. I think he had 3 or 4 goals in his first 5 or 6 games. And that kind of just took off. And obviously his minutes went from 12 minutes under Bruce Boudreau to 15, 16, 17 minutes and scoring earlier in the season. And then all of a sudden it was gone and the training wheels come off, and Eriksson Ek was now the Eriksson Ek that we drafted 20th overall. And everybody develops at a different time. Obviously scoring early would really, really help Marco in his confidence for sure. You just don't want to get 10 games into the season and have him sitting with no goals and no assists. So yeah, that's a great point, Joe. And hopefully he can get off the snide earlier than later.
What has impressed you the most about Brock Faber in the early portion of his NHL career?
His hockey sense. For a regular fan, the first thing that jumps to your mind, that jumps off the sheet and off the ice at you or off the television screen, is the way he skates. Obviously he's an NHL skater. That jumps off the sheet at me or at the video screen, but the way he thinks the game, Joe, is special. I watch him defensively, and obviously the 7 years that or 8 years that I played with the Minnesota Wild, I spent a lot of time in my own zone. I got to know our goaltenders very, very well, playing against the other team's better players. So I watch tendencies. I watch players, how they close. I love watching players in their own end of the rink. And Brock Faber's positioning and his attention to detail and stick position and his ability to close on an offensive player under control, but with tremendous balance, so that he has actually 2 or 3 cracks at getting a stick on it. Like, a lot of defensemen will close, they'll lunge a little bit, and if they miss with their stick on the puck, now they're out of position because they've lunged just a little bit. He's able to be powerful from a balanced position. It's almost like you got to beat him 4 times to get to the front of the net. That's what's really impressed me the most about this kid's game. And obviously he's been coached very well. Bob Motzko had him there for a couple of years, at the U with the Gophers. And, the fact that him and Jonas Brodin are going to play together at the start of the season, good luck trying to score against those two guys defensively the way they are in their own zone. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what Jonas Brodin and Brock Faber can bring to the table, especially as the season kind of grows and we get kind of into Christmas in January, and see if that offensive game can grow on both ends. I could see them both, Joe, taking more chances offensively as the season goes on, because they're both so good defensively and they're so fast. They're going to be able to take some chances. So for those guys to take the next step, I want those two guys to actually almost be reckless. They're that good of skaters.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it plays.
And it's a very different partner that Brodin used to have in Matt Dumba, from Dumba being, we always think of offense and push the pace and the big hits and the big shot. And Brodin, kind of, we all have been told, whether it's completely accurate or not, that would be a coaching thing or a video thing, you'd know better than me, but like, Brodin covers for Dumba is what we always thought. Now with Faber and his skating ability and the offensive game growing, maybe to your point, yeah, you see a Jonas Brodin that the point total goes up a bit. He doesn't feel like he has to sort of stay back as much. Is that fair?
It is fair. And I would say Matt Dumba's defensive game, in my opinion, in his own zone, when you get down in the defensive zone, Matt Dumba was I would say average defensively. He wasn't a liability defensively. In my opinion, sometimes where Matt would get himself in trouble is kind of in the neutral zone, playing against speed, because he's a great skater forward, but backwards not quite as good. So a lot of times you would see Jonas Brodin kind of drift back quicker than he would if the attack come down on Matt Dumba's side. he would kind of drift back just to kind of protect his other partner in case somebody blew by Matt Dumba. So now that's going to be Brock Faber over there. He's going to be playing up in somebody's face and not worried about somebody blowing by him. Now, when you turn over a puck with a good stick, we just talked about Brock Faber's stick. Now it's time for the other defenseman on the other side to maybe get involved in the offense off of that quick turnover. So I think, Joe, you're going to see more turnovers in the neutral zone with these two guys because of their ability to skate, as opposed to now with Matt Dumba kind of involved. You almost pretty much knew coming down that side of the ice, you're gonna have to play in your own zone. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
Sure.
I envision a lot more turnovers in the neutral zone, and I do think that those two guys, Faber and Brodin, are gonna be playing a lot with Hartman's line and Kirill Kaprizov. So that's going to make those guys even more dangerous if they're able to stay up in the neutral zone and create more turnovers.
Yeah, fuel that transition game and let those
Yeah.
skill guys go to work.
Yeah.
What are your expectations from the goaltending position? I'd have to imagine there's got to be some regression to the norm for Filip Gustavsson. I mean, 2.10 save percentage of 930 or whatever it was. Like, I'd love to see it again. I hope that we see it again. But what do you expect from not only the man they call Gus, but also Marc-Andre Fleury, the soon-to-be Hall of Famer?
Those numbers were ridiculous. I don't think fans really truly understand like what a 930 save percentage is. It's amazing to be that good for that long. I think after the New Year, the American New Year's or Thanksgiving, his numbers were off the charts. I'm watching him in practice, Joe. Obviously, he's got his new 3-year deal in his back pocket. His work habits in practice here have been great through training camp. He looks very confident. I don't see any reason why, and I think I'm not sure, Joe, and you would know this if the Wild. I think they finished in the top 10 in save percentage, did they not last year?
Yes.
Like right around maybe 7th to 10th. Like I don't see any reason why that should change, especially because of the way the Wild defend. They don't give up a lot of 2-on-1s. They don't give up a whole lot off of the rush. So anytime you're not giving up scoring chances off the rush, save percentages are always going to be high. That's why it's great for goaltenders to play in our system. Great for numbers. It helps. My biggest concern with Gus is the fact that, looking at his numbers, the most starts he's ever had was last year, 37 starts. To be a number one, you got to start drifting around that 50 to 60 range. Can he handle the extra workload later in the season when your body kind of breaks down a little bit? But I think going into this season, Joe, and I don't know if you agree with me, but I think it's going to be I think both goalies are going to share the net. I wouldn't be surprised, especially the first 10 games of the season, if they're alternating back and forth and one goalie plays four, one plays six, maybe 5-on-5, just to get both goaltenders, get them feeling the puck a little bit and feeling good about their game. But yeah, this team's going to only go as far as their goaltending takes them, and getting Filip Gustavsson locked in for those 3 years was gigantic. And man, is his game. It's gone to another level. And Billy Guerin, I mean, that's got to be one of the greatest fleecings of all time. I mean, what he to pick him up for Cam Talbot, a kid that was 7 years younger, and now we pick up a potentially a number one goaltender that changes our organization. And that's not the first move that Billy made that's really set this organization in a good way. But time will tell.
Yeah, and of course, Talbot not even with the Senators anymore. So they essentially got a 1-year rental in Cam Talbot and didn't even really pan out there.
Yeah.
Walsy, third in the NHL in save percentage last year at
Oh wow.
914 as a team behind the
Even
Bruins and
better,
the
even better than
Islanders.
I thought.
In the faceoff circle, it bugs my partner in the radio booth, Tom Reed, every night when they're at 46%, 47%. We saw the Dallas Stars score some goals in that playoff series. It came directly off offensive zone draws, Wild defensive zone draws. Can the Wild be better? How can they be better this year in the faceoff circle?
Well, they could be better if they brought Bergeron out of retirement, maybe Mark Messier back. I'm sure you could fit them in under the cap situation, but listen, the faceoff circle is going to be a struggle. It just is with the centerman that we have in our organization. Erickson Ek is I believe he finished at 949.4%, which is he's closing in on 50%. Marco Rossi's going to help. I believe he just was over 50%. That's definitely going to help. But Ryan Hartman not great in the faceoff circle. Connor Dewar, I think for his career is 44%. So listen, it's going to be a struggle. Like just like the goal for the Wild for me should be about 46. Like, don't try to get to 50%. Just be around 45 to 50% throughout the season. And you know what, during obviously face-offs at the end of the game are the most important at the end of periods. When teams have power plays and shorthanded, you know, those are really important moments of the game. I don't care so much about neutral zone face-offs and things like that. So, I don't know what to tell you, Joe. You know, I was probably a 50% face-off guy. I was not great in the circle, and whenever I would get crushed, I'd always say my wingers aren't helping me enough. So always blame the wingers. Blame the wingers if you're getting crushed in the face-off circle. So, but anyway, I don't think it's going to get much easier for your partner upstairs, Tom. He's going to be dealing with the same stuff all season long.
Kirill Kaprizov, any similarities to Marian Gaborik, a guy you played with? What do you see there between arguably two of the greatest superstar caliber players the Wild have ever had?
Characteristics. They're completely different players, Joe. I think the one characteristic that they share is their desire to be great. Marian had that at a young age too. You know, Marian, the first 4 or 5 years there in Minnesota, if you're looking at their game from a skating standpoint, Marian Gaborik's straight ahead speed was unmatched in the NHL for years. Like, he was one of the fastest straight line skaters that the NHL has had and was for many, many years. Kirill is a different skater. He's not a blazer. Think about how many times during the season he would blow by a defenseman and score a goal. It just doesn't happen.
Right.
Maybe once in a while, but he's more of a is able to maneuver and has agility in the corners that Marian did not have. Unfortunately for Marian, his centerman was named Wes Walls, and he had to play with me like the first 3 or 4 years of his career. Kirill Kaprizov has a not a centerman, but a guy he's able to play with called Matt Zuccarello, and he's the connection that those two guys have is really something to behold, and it's just amazing that our Wild fans get a chance to watch that every night. So their desire to win and to be great players, Kirill Kaprizov and Marian Gaborik, is very equal. They're both great players, but I think what separates Kirill from Marian is Kirill's ability to be very agile in his skating and actually not just scoring goals, but actually able to see the ice as well too. I would say he's a better passer than Marian as well too, but both great superstars. And you know, if you had to ask me, if I had to put one, who's been the best player ever, I would have to say Kirill Kaprizov. We've never seen anything like what this guy can do every night.
He just received the A on his sweater, which is a great honor. What kind of leader, and I'm glad this happened today, because I read the piece in The Athletic with Joe Smith and Michael Russo, and they had you quoted in there about, you know, sometimes, you know, you played with Ray Bourque, you played with other great leaders that didn't have to say a whole lot. Where does Kaprizov sort of fit in from a leadership standpoint, in your opinion?
Well, obviously, you know, Kirill is still trying to learn the English language. It's a work in progress. It's definitely getting better for sure. It sounds like he's watching a lot of movies during the summer, and I think just staying here in North America during the summer is going to help with his English. But in my experience, the best leaders have always been, for me anyway, I can't speak for everybody else, have been quiet leaders. And when I say quiet leaders, I mean like not mute. It's not like they'd never get up in front of a locker room, but they had such a, like Ray Bourque and Steve Yzerman, and I was only around those guys for 2 years each, but they had such an innate ability to recognize when it was time to get up and talk in front of the group. And I think when captains do it only from time to time, I think it's very, very powerful. And it was so powerful watching Ray Bourque and Steve Yzerman go about their business, because they were such respected athletes because of how they went about their business, how hard they prepared, how hard they played, and the fact that they were superstars. Now, having a guy like Kirill Kaprizov in the locker room and giving him an A on his jersey where he's going to be part of the leadership group. Like, I was thinking to myself this afternoon, I was walking back to my vehicle after, you know, watching practice. Like, if I was in a room with Kirill Kaprizov and it's 30 games into the season and we lost 3 or 4 or 5 games in a row, and we're after the first period at home, and he closes all the doors and tells the trainers to get out of the room, and he takes a minute or two and just berates everybody and gets in people's faces and talks about how this is not even close to enough. Like, I can't even, like, I get goosebumps just thinking about it if I was in that locker room listening to that guy. Now, if I had to listen to him once a week give his speech, it wouldn't have as much impact. But the fact that he is still struggling a little bit with his English, and he's not going to do it often, but I just think having that kind of clout, the way he goes about his business and how respected he is, Joe, when he, and it's not going to happen often during the year, but when it does happen, man, I'm telling you, it's going to be awfully, awfully powerful when you've got your best player, your superstar, play as hard as he does. And again, if you're going to tear a strip of paint off the locker room in between periods, you better go out and back it up. And Kirill kind of has that ability to back it up too. So just, I actually thought Eriksson Ek was going to get the A, but now giving it more thought, the way things have played out, just my own mind going back to early in my careers and some of these superstars being captains and leaders, I really do think it's going to pay dividends for the Wild.
How do you size up the Central Division? And I'm particularly interested in your thoughts on the Nashville Predators and their new head coach and Andrew Brunette, who obviously you know very well.
I mean, I don't have a whole lot to add other than what everybody else is saying about the Central. I think it's, I don't think the Central's much of a mystery, to be perfectly honest with you. I think everybody recognizes the Colorado Avalanche and Dallas Stars, especially if they can stay healthy all season long. They're going to be right at the top. We all know that they're going to be, battling for 1-2. I'm not saying the Wild can't jump in there at all and have a chance to win the division. But between the Minnesota Wild for me, Joe, the Nashville Predators, the Winnipeg Jets, and the St. Louis Blues, for me, those four teams, one of those four teams are going to finish in the three spot. I do think the Wild have the inside track to the number three spot if everyone can stay healthy and they continue to get great goaltending. You brought up the Nashville Predators. Andrew Brunette, who I played with for many years there, was coached in Florida. He brings a unique outlook on how to play hockey to the Nashville Predators. Obviously, anytime, Joe, you think of the Nashville Predators, you think about great defensively. You think of Roman Josi, you think of some of these high-end defensemen that they've had that play 20, 25 minutes a game, and you think about good defensive hockey. But I'm telling you, and Andrew likes good defense too, but he wants his players to play a little bit of run and gun, kind of like how they played in Florida when they won the President's Trophy and under his head coaching abilities too. So Nashville, for me, is going to be one of those teams that are going to be fighting for that number three spot with the Wild. And to me, Joe, it's all going to come down to, between St. Louis, Winnipeg, Nashville, and the Wild, it's going to come down to how those teams play against each other and how many wins you can get in regulation. And the team that, proves best out of them, I think, has a good chance of finishing in the number three hole. But that doesn't mean none of those teams either could jump in and give Dallas and Colorado a run for their money at the top. So that's kind of where I see the Central.
Describe Wes Walls the player. Wait a minute, you have to think about this?
It's been so, it's been 15 years, Joe. I got to think back. I guess it depends what year you ask me, the beginning of my career or the end of my career. I'd
Well,
say at the beginning,
how much did it differ?
a lot. I mean, it was night and day. The beginning of my career, I played 17 years as a professional hockey player. The first 7, 8 years of my career, drafted by the Boston Bruins and kind of trying to figure out how I'm going to play in the National Hockey League. The first 6 years of my career, Joe, I'd spent just as many games in the American Hockey League as I did in the NHL. So I was up and down a whole lot. I don't really think I realized how hard I needed to work earlier in my career. I think I took a lot of things for granted. And that's probably why I had to go over to Switzerland to kind of recreate my career. And so my wife and I decided after our sixth year, we decided, got a great opportunity to go over to Zug, Switzerland, play in the Swiss Elite League over there. I knew I was going to stay in this, was going to live in the same home every night. They paid me great money over there. And I was just going to go over there for 1 year to kind of get away from things, like I said, I'd been in the American Hockey League, NHL, all over the place, didn't really stick anywhere. 1 year turned out to be 4 years, and had a great experience playing over there in Switzerland. And fortunately for me, I was fortunate enough to obviously have the NHL expand by the Minnesota Wild and Columbus Blue Jackets, and Doug Risebrough reached out to my agent after my 4th year there in Switzerland, and asked if I'd be interested and ready to come back. So that's a whole nother story in and of itself. And this might be an interesting backstory I don't think that I've shared with many people. And I ended up talking to Doug Risebrough after my career was over. We were up in the press box one night. I said, how the hell did you ever, how did you find me over in Switzerland? Like, I was out of the league for 4 years. I know Doug Risebrough was the assistant general manager in Calgary when I played there. And he said to me, and this will interest maybe Minnesota North Star fans to listen to this, but he said Pierre Pagé was quietly a consultant for us and working for the Minnesota Wild. And he happened to be one of the coaches for one of the teams in the Swiss League, for Ambry. We had Zug had beat out Ambry in the play in the semifinals to go to the finals. So basically, to make a long story short, Joe, Pierre Pagé had a lot to do with me coming, putting in a good word for me and giving me an opportunity. And then Doug Risebrough signed me to that contract. But the original question was like, what was I like at the beginning of my career compared to the end, the last 7, 8 years? Joe, I was much more serious, the last 7 years of my career. Much wiser hockey player, much better hockey player. I didn't realize playing in Switzerland for 4 years, the amount of pressure that's on the imports to have to score and carry the mail, made me a better player. I think playing on a bigger ice surface in Europe helped with my skating. I was always a good skater before I went over there, but I think my skating even went to another level. And then when I came back with the Minnesota Wild, I was 30 years old. I had been through a lot of pressure. I had failed early in my career to be a full-time NHL player. I was wise enough to recognize this was going to be my last kick at the can. And Joe, for 7, 8 years of my life, every year I played for the Minnesota Wild, I can count on one hand the amount of times I went out and had partied with my friends. I didn't party. I didn't drink. I drank water and ate chicken and fish and really slept properly. My diet changed. I trained like an animal every summer because I knew this was the last 7, 8 years of my career. And I always wanted, when I was finished, to look back and feel proud of what I had accomplished in my career. And fortunately for me, the Wild took a chance on me, and I was able to deliver with some good years for them. And more importantly, after my career was over, I just feel proud about what I was able to accomplish the last few years. But again, if the NHL doesn't really expand, Joe, I'd quietly agreed to play for another 4 years over there in Switzerland and Lugano, making great money, and I was prepared to do that. But I don't think I ever, I still think if I would have finished my career over in Switzerland, Joe, I don't think I would have been, as proud of my careers as with the way it turned out, getting an opportunity to come back.
I appreciate that backstory and the international experience as well, because I wanted to talk to you about that. So I like how you tied it all together and really summed up how it all came about. Because I, looking at your bio, it's like, hey, he left the NHL or the AHL or North American experience to go play in Europe, and then he's back and rounds out his career. Really crazy how that all came about and cool stuff. I'm glad ultimately it worked out for you because. As much as I'm sure the European experience was awesome, I'm guessing your goal was to be a full-time NHLer at some point. Is that right?
Yeah, of course it was. I mean, it was always my dream as a young kid, but those early, the first years from 20 years old to 26 years old, I didn't take it serious enough. I was not taking care of my body off the ice, not getting proper sleep. I just thought I was going to play forever, and I was a fool. And when you're 30 years old, you recognize looking back 10 years later how big a fool you were, and I just didn't want that to happen again. So yeah, my career, Joe, was like very, very unique. I don't know how many players have played like 250 games in the American Hockey League, 200 over in Europe, and then 600 in the NHL. I'm sure that list is probably pretty short. So, it just I got so much better over there. I didn't really realize at the time how much better of a hockey player I was when I came back as a 30-year-old, but my speed was better. This new coach came, Jacques Lemaire, had been around a long time. And when Jacques Lemaire, Joe, was given the head coaching position, I just put my head down. I was so scared because I was never known. Even when I played in the NHL, I was never known as a defensive player. As a matter of fact, Joe, you'll love this story. When I played in the NHL, those 150 games, 200, a lot of them in Calgary under Dave King, anytime there was somebody, an opponent on the ice that at any point in his career had scored more than 25 goals in a season at any time, I had to race off of the ice because our coach was so scared. That's how bad
Come
defensively I
on.
was. I'm not lying to you. And I ain't stretching the truth at all.
And
So
then you made
the fact
yourself
that
into a Selke trophy candidate.
that happened earlier in my career,
Yeah.
and the fact that Jacques Lemaire turned me into a checking center and almost won the Selke one year and ended up being his checking centerman, it's you just never would have thought that that would happen. I always felt I had the ability and the hockey sense to be able to do it, but somebody believed in me, and his name was Jacques Lemaire. And when you play as long as I did, and I'd mentioned earlier during this podcast about Marian Gaborik and playing with high-end players, Jacques wanted me to play to be the high guy in the offensive zone all the time and not get trapped down low because he wanted me to play against the best players in the world in my own zone. And he wanted me to have a full tank of gas all the time because he knew I could be in there for 2 minutes.
Right.
And so when I came back to the bench and he would look at me sideways if I got caught up on the offensive side too much, I had already played in the minors. I had already played over in Switzerland. I had to go over there for 4 years. Marian Gaborik or Pavel Dimitra never had to go through what I went through. That's why I did everything my coach told me to do. And I'm glad I did because I was able to play for another till I was like 38 years old. And like I understand those guys, being frustrated with me not getting involved in the offense as much as I could have or wanted to. Joe, I was a big scorer myself. Like I wanted to get involved in the offense, but I also wanted to play in the NHL. So that's how that all came about. So yeah, an interesting career and one I'm awfully proud of.
It's amazing opportunity and belief from a coach, a GM, whatever, and how that can either get a player's career jump-started, keep them around, or in some ways, essentially end the dream.
It's I mean it's I'm still I still have to pinch myself every once in a while just to, how the last 7, 8 years of my career ended, considering what had happened the first 10 years. I'll never forget the first training camp we had up at Parade Ice Garden in Minneapolis for tryouts. I had trained so hard that summer when I came back and I was ready for camp. And I was just flying around, Joe, kind of like an idiot, just trying to get noticed I'll never forget about 4 or 5 days into training camp. And again, my goal is just to make the team. And I know Jacques Lemaire. I know Jacques Lemaire, if you're on a one-way contract and you're not good enough, you're going to go to the American Hockey League. Not like it was the early years of my career where I would be on a two-way, outplay guys on one-ways, and then I'd have to go to the minors all the time. That was one of the reasons why I told Doug Risebrough, the only way I'm coming back is I need a one-way. I'm not outplaying players anymore. And then having to go to the minors. So that Doug Risebrough did give me my one way, but that's a whole nother story. But yeah, I lost my train of thought what I was talking about there before that whole scenario. But
Well, you were
anyway.
just saying that, at training camp 4 or 5 days in,
Jock.
you're
So after
buzzing, right?
yeah, Joe. So Jock and Mario, much like they probably when they played for the Montreal Canadiens, having a smoke in between periods. They were outside the building, and after practice was over, and I was walking out to my vehicle. And they were around the corner from the rink, and they said, "Hey, Wes, come here." I was walking to my car, and I went over and met with them. And they had Jock had mentioned to me. He said, "Listen, these are my thoughts for you. I want to see if you can be my checking centerman. You made the team," is basically what he told me, Joe. And actually, after he said, "You made the team," I barely remembered anything else that he had said because I just wanted to make the team that year. That's all I cared about. He wanted me to be his checking center. And so what he said to me, "I want you for the rest of training camp," he told me basically, "I want you to slow down. I don't want you flying around the ice anymore." He wanted to test me to see if I had a mind for the game. And So once I had showed him I was in great shape, I was prepared, I kind of changed the way I played after the first week of camp to try to show him that I was smart enough to be a great defensive player. And that's kind of how that all really evolved. But I'll never forget jumping in my vehicle on that drive home, Joe, 5 days into camp, like almost crying, like saying this to my wife, like Jacques Lemaire just told me I made the team. And so it was a day that I'll never really forget. And obviously it was up to me to take care of the defensive end of things. But yeah, it was a lot of fun playing under him and teammates back then. Obviously, we all had a story. We were an expansion team. And I never played with a group of players those 6 or 7 years. Well, not so much the 6 or 7, but the first 2 or 3 years of expansion. And when we went on that run in 03 was just something that was special and something I'll never, ever forget. And Jacques Lemaire has fingerprints really all over that.
What made that 2003 team so special? The team that's had the most postseason success in a single wild season?
Well, I mean, obviously just what I'd mentioned, Joe, we all cared about each other. We all loved each other so much. We had a really good team. We had a very fast team. Antti Laaksonen, myself, Pascal Dupuis, Richard Park, Marian Gaborik, and the list goes on and on. Like we may not have had the high-end talent guys, but we had a very, very fast team. So we felt that we could play with some of the top teams in the league, especially if we got good goaltending. And halfway through that season, Joe, our power play was not great. And we traded for Cliff Ronning about halfway through that season, a guy that had been around a long, long time, great power play guy. He took our power play to another level, and he gave us an opportunity to score goals on the power play because of the way he could distribute the puck. And actually, in that playoff run, that playoff run we went on 0-3, our power play won us so many games, and a lot of it had to do with the move that Doug Risebrough had made to bring in Cliff Ronning at 36 years old. So, listen, we never got out coached. Matchups were a very, very important part of how and why we had our success. So guys had to get on and off the ice, even when we played out on the road and we didn't get last change, Joe. We had players coming on and off the ice all the time. We wouldn't change three, four players. We changed a lot of times the centerman would be me and Darby and Jimmy Dowd that would be coming on and off the ice. So we had to be sharp on the bench all the time to make sure that we wanted to make sure we had the right players on the ice at the right time. And we got great goaltending during that run. And I think Colorado obviously overlooked the Minnesota Wild in those early years. And I don't think many people gave us credit, gave us thought we could beat them one time. So the fact that we were able to beat them 4 times in a 7-game series, you don't do that. Like, you don't beat a team 4-7, and it's not luck. I don't care what anybody says. We had a much better team than people gave us credit for. And yeah, we were able to down 3 games to 1 twice in a row, fight back. And the one game that sticks out to me and all that whole run that we had there was the overtime goal that Andrew Burnett scored in overtime. Joe, I think Andrew Burnett scored 3 minutes into the overtime. And I'm almost positive that in that overtime, we played 2 minutes and 45 seconds in our own zone. The only time we came out of our zone after the first 3 minutes of that overtime was when we scored. It was amazing. And there weren't many positives when COVID all happened and everything, Joe, but one of the positives that did happen was the Bally's like played a lot of those old games from the 2003 run. And I, other than highlights, I had never sat there and watched the game from beginning to end. And it was a joy just to sit there and watch these games back. And I'd always told people the story about the overtime. They scored 3 minutes in and we were in our zone for 20 seconds. I nailed it. It was 20 seconds. We were in the offensive zone and we ended up scoring that goal. So anyway, it was an amazing run, and something we still talk about from time to time. And hopefully, under Kirill Kaprizov and everyone else we have in that locker room, we can put that 0-3 run to bed and celebrate a new run here at some point.
I want to have you talk about family life and hockey schools and stuff real quick. But first, or before I get there, I should say, what makes a great penalty killer?
I've never really had that question posed that way, but just thinking about it now, Joe, to be a great penalty killing team, it's almost like you have to work in unison, right? Like I could be a great penalty killer, but if you don't work with me, Joe, and Mark doesn't work with you, like it works as a group, right? They all work together. So the greatest penalty killing teams that I've ever had play for, they play together as a group. But if you're asking me individually, like what one player, what he needs to be a great penalty killer, it's hockey IQ, it's hockey sense, it's like recognizing where the puck's going to go 3, 4 seconds before it happens. I had the advantage of being a big scorer when I played in junior, and I scored a little bit in the NHL. It wasn't like I was just like a fourth line guy, but so I had some ability to understand how like the top players in the world, kind of what their mind is like. So I had an idea about how they think and certain tendencies from certain players. But anyway, hockey IQ for me, having a great stick, and then being able to, like, after they move it around 3 or 4 times, there's times, Joe, when you have to lay it on the line and get down and block shots. It's never ever any fun. And I missed quite a few games in those 7, 8 years over the years. I think a couple seasons there with the Wild, I played like 60 games, and a lot of it was just, pucks in the hand and shoulder and all. So you gotta lay out and block shots, and that's part of the whole deal. It's never any fun, but especially in those early years, that was something that we took a lot of pride in.
You and your wife have 5 kids. I'm sure that keeps you extremely busy. I'm not sure of their age range, so you can share that if you'd like. But the West Walls Hockey School, you do a ton of work with the Minnesota Wild, away from the rink and community efforts. You've been an ambassador for the game, obviously, for the organization for a long time. How do you balance all this stuff? The West Walls Hockey School, you used to coach high school hockey in the area. What's all that off the ice like for you?
Yeah, I mean it's still pretty busy. So my as you mentioned, we have 5 kids. My oldest is 30. He's playing actually over in Germany this year. This is his fifth or sixth year playing over in Europe. He's a really a good little hockey player. He's 30 years old, married now. My oldest daughter's 27. She just had her first grandchild or a child, so I'm now a grandfather.
Congrats.
Yeah, thank you. That's been amazing to have the grand our grandson around here. And we have another one in the way in a couple months, so that's exciting too. I have a 23-year-old daughter. Then we had a 9-year gap between 8 or 9 year gap between our third and fourth child, and then when our fourth daughter came along, we decided to have another one right away, so that they could kind of grow up together. Our fifth and sixth child, or sorry, our fourth and fifth child. My fifth boy is now 14, so he's just starting his first year of Bantam hockey. And so, listen, I've been around the youth hockey thing here now, it feels like, for 25 years. And yeah, it's a busy time between all the Wild work. I can't be the head coach of the Bantam team, but I help out on the ice. I'm one of the assistant coaches as much as I possibly can. Go on tournaments. I'm on the bench, so I'm part of the team. And I really do enjoy being around youth hockey. As you mentioned, I got my hockey school, the West Walls Minnesota Wild Hockey School, that I've ran for, I think we just finished our 10th or 11th year. And there's been so much demand for the hockey school. We ran 4 straight weeks in August. And trust me, Joe, being around 7 to 13-year-old boys and girls from 9 o'clock in the morning, 8 in the morning till 4 o'clock. I usually have a couple beers on Friday afternoon after the day. Those beers taste pretty good because I've earned them. But the hockey school is great. The Wild have been so grateful to give every participant for the hockey school 4 lower bowl seats to a Wild preseason game. They get 25% off at the hockey lodge. Wild players usually come and sign autographs for the kids. So I just, you know what? I went to a lot of hockey schools growing up, and I had so much fun. And the Wild, allow me to run this hockey school. They help me market it, and it's really taken off. And I take a lot of pride in it because I see how much fun the families have and the kids have. So yeah, busy chasing kids around. I know you're in the middle of the youth hockey scenario too with all your kids. I believe you have 3 children, right, Joe?
Yeah, 3 boys, and I will be picking your brain on flights this year because I'm helping out with the Pee Wee team here in Edina for our now 13-year-old. That second year
Oh yeah,
Pee-wee.
one of the 35 Pee-wee teams they have in Edina.
Yeah, it's competitive.
Yeah, it is competitive, but yeah, no, the youth hockey thing is awesome, and I just it keeps me young, right? Keeps me young. I'm in a rink pretty much every night. I really do enjoy it.
All right, lastly, I got quick hits. There are five quick questions. I want the first thing that comes to mind, all right?
All right.
One former teammate you haven't seen in a while that you'd love to have a beer with.
Manny Fernandez.
One regret from your playing career.
Too many beers in my early 20s.
Your favorite Minnesota restaurant.
Oh, Tom Reed's.
Minnesota sporting event you'd most like to attend as a fan.
A Super Bowl game, Vikings Super Bowl game at a neutral site. Obviously, that would be really cool. You said one word, Wes.
No, you're good. Well, first thought, really.
Okay, thought. Got it.
You're doing great. Lastly, let's say the Minnesota Wild don't win the Stanley Cup in 2024. Who's your pick to win it?
I'm going to say the Edmonton Oilers. And I don't like their goaltending right now, Joe, but I think if they're in the hunt around if they're in the hunt around the break, and they will be, I think they're going to go at to get a goal, get a goalie and try it. I think they got to start winning Stanley Cups as long as McDavid's there, or else they're going to move on. Right, Joe? I'm
right.
Going to say the Edmonton Oilers.
Okay. Wes, I appreciate it. Of course, our listeners follow him on Twitter at Walls3737. That's WALZ3737 on Twitter. Check him out on Bally Sports North. I enjoy our camaraderie. I really do love your insight. I'm not just blowing smoke here. I don't know that I've told you that, but I do really enjoy chatting with you, understanding the game a little bit through your vision and insight. So thank you for doing this. I know you're such a busy guy, but I really wanted to get this done before the season started. Thank you so much for your time. Congrats on obviously a great playing career, and look forward to, you know, all your work in the broadcast booth and as a studio host.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Joel. This was a lot of fun, and I look forward to helping you with the youth hockey thing and getting your kids through that. That's
gonna need some break. Gonna need some neutral zone regroup drills from you when we're on the bird. Again, my thanks to Wes Walls for joining me. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to like, subscribe, follow. As always, presented by Soda Stick, 1-on-1 with Joe O'Donnell. Thanks for tuning in.